When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrillo.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey everyone, hope you've had a great week so far. We are excited to bring you this episode today. Before we get into it, I've got to know, Sebastian, what's your favorite local spot? Like, that you could walk to or maybe drive to?
Okay. So I have a lot because I love walking to places. Well,
you got
to
pick one.
I got to pick one. So the one I'm currently going a lot to is called Guajitos Miami Eatery. And this is essentially a restaurant, but there's a few places here in Charlottesville that have a thing called Café con Leche, which is, it's essentially a type of latte if you want to think about it like that. And about with different proportions of milk and coffee, whatever. And I love it. I get like a little pastelito or something like a little Cuban pastry, let's say. And I come back and it's like literally 3-4 minutes, like 3 minutes walking from my place. So like I come back within 10 minutes and it's great. I love it. What about you?
So I live fairly close, not that close, but like a half mile or something from this like ultra super hipster coffee shop.
Okay.
It's like, it's one of those places. It's like so hip. You go in there and you're like, I don't belong in here. Like there's influencers here. They have like the big hats and stuff, but like the coffee is just phenomenal. It's called Provider. Okay. And like, I'd still go there during the pandemic. They have it all like set up. So I feel like I'm not going to immediately get COVID upon entry. So
perfect.
What about you, Jonathan?
Oh boy. I have to say it's probably the bar in my house.
Right.
Nice.
The conveniently famous bar, located 10 feet away from my bedroom. And, always serves what I want and price is right too.
That is taking local to the next level. All right.
That is a really good hidden curriculum tip right there.
To have alcohol.
His bar is well known. Yeah.
All right. So our special guest today is Jonathan Meir. He is the Mary Julia and George R. Jordan Professor of Economics at Texas A&M and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Jonathan's research focuses on charitable giving and the economics of education. His recent work examines whether fundraising creates new giving, the impact of minimum wage on search effort, and how the interaction between teacher and student gender affects student performance. And I think very impressively, Jonathan teaches 2,500 online students a year, a very large number. That's probably more than many people have taught in 10 years or maybe in a whole career. Jonathan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, guys. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. And we always want our guests to share a fun fact about themselves, just to lighten it up a little bit. What is your shareable fun fact?
Well, so I mentioned the bar. I am very domestic, but I also bring the same unhealthy obsession for detail to everything I do. So I do a lot of gardening and I do a lot of baking. And often I turn the stuff from my garden into alcohol and then enjoy it alongside fresh baked goods. It's
wow.
Just
nice.
Wow. I want to come to your place and just have like a little like treat from your garden and a little drink. That sounds great.
Now, sometimes when we have conferences or workshops here or seminar speakers, my bar is open.
Okay. That's awesome.
So what's like do you have like a go-to pairing or is there a thing like a combo you like to do? Like,
you know, it really depends on the mood I'm in. And, you know, that depends on the weather, the kind of day I've had, the company I'm keeping. But, you know, it's nice because you can make it really bespoke to your experience, really complement the experience you're having.
I like it. So in COVID, it's just like I'm eating some stale bread and here's like some whiskey in a cup.
But we got to make up for all the crushing disappointments we're having in all other aspects of our lives.
Yeah. There you go. Right. That's maybe not necessarily a healthy coping mechanism for our audience, but coping mechanism regardless.
Yeah. All right. So before we dive into today's topic, let's talk about your work. Is there some paper or other project that you'd like to promote?
So I'm working on a number of projects, but what I want to highlight today is an outreach workshop for high school guidance and college counselors. So people in economics talk a lot about a leaky pipeline being the reason for lower levels of representation, disappointing levels of representation. But I think that that's somewhat misleading. To me, the mouth of the pipeline is the problem. And that's not to say that the support, mentorship, and culture changes that people are working on later in the process aren't important. They really are. They're really valuable. But at A&M, students have to select a major on application. Now, they can change that later. But it turns out that when I dove into the data, those gender and race gaps that we see later in the process are basically fully formed before they've ever set foot on campus. And if you look at AP economics test taking, you see the same pattern. So I spent a lot of time with this, and it seems like a big part of it is that there's a big misunderstanding about what economics really is. So students think it's all stock market and finance, you know, should I buy GameStop?
My parents think that too.
And to the extent that, you know, some particular groups are less interested in those topics, there's less take up. So I set out to reach high school guidance and college counselors to help change some of those perceptions, since they interact with hundreds of students in every cohort. And then when Danila Serra joined our department, she convinced me to randomize the invitations to the counselors so that we could measure the impact. And in fall of 2019, we brought a group of counselors to A&M, you know, nice presentation, box lunch, tour of campus. This was in the before time, the long, long ago, when you could still do that sort of thing. And, you know, we gave them short presentations about economics. Basically, 80% economics is great and diverse and applicable, and 20% economics at A&M specifically is great, including a bunch of stuff from our really amazing students who just absolutely stole the show. And we got amazing feedback from the counselors. And we've been following up with enrollment, application enrollment data at A&M. And down the line, we may try to get into those Texas data to see whether there was spillover economics majoring at other schools. And now we did it again this past fall, virtually, of course, with another round of randomization. But the goal that I had in the back of my head when I started down this path was that 10 or 15 years from now, there'd be a dozen or so people with PhDs in economics from underrepresented groups who wouldn't have done so otherwise. They might have gone to A&M, they might not. And they might not even be able to tell you about that one offhand conversation they had with a counselor that got them to try an intro course at A&M or at UT or Sam Houston or wherever that got them interested and got them down that path. And we're never going to pick that up in the data. But I'm okay with that, because that's the kind of hard long run work that I think we have to do to make a real difference.
This is really cool. I've thought about this a little bit too, in that it just, like, if you look at like the C-SWEP data for like, you know, this is like troubling thing of like the percent of women in like these various positions in academia. It's bad at the beginning, right? And I think the graph that they put online isn't like, doesn't have AP test scores. But I mean, this is like, I think this is like a really important point that like, and having more people enter is a
we need to have all the stages, and especially right at the beginning. I'm curious about this feedback that you heard from the college counselors. What kind of feedback was like that positive feedback?
Oh, it was so gratifying. So one of them said something like, you know, I was really annoyed that my principal told me that I should go to this, but now I'm wishing that I'd majored in economics when I was in college. You know, because Danila does this amazing job of sort of going through her own personal story and how she got interested in economics and how she was resistant to it, you know, thinking it was all finance and whatever, and how she discovered it was about human behavior and all these super interesting interaction things. So she does an amazing job. These students come in, they talk about their research or what got them interested. And, you know, I talk about what's available there, the research that I've done with students in the past. And, you know, they come away with a much clearer understanding of what economics really is. And we make a point of telling them, you know, this is for your students who maybe aren't sure what they want to do with their lives. You know, they're pretty good at the quantitative stuff, but they're interested in people. And we really push it for economics broadly, not necessarily economics at A&M. And hopefully, you know, we get some of these positive spillovers also. But it really is public goods production.
But then we're shying them away from other majors, right? Maybe their life would have been so much better. No, I'm just kidding.
You know, I actually worry about that sometimes. I really do, because I bring in top students. I try to talk to some of the top students from my online course. Mm-hmm. And I will often have some trepidation or not necessarily reach out to a top student from an underrepresented background who I can see is an electrical engineering major, because it's not like electrical engineering is doing that well. But I really push when I see someone who's doing different social science and say, look, you scored in the top 2% of this class that has, you know, thousands of people in it. You're really good at this sort of thing. Take another class, give it a try, see what you think. And yeah, it has a fairly low success rate, but sometimes I get them to minor, sometimes even switch and do a major, but at least open their eyes a little bit to a path they might not have been thinking about.
Totally. I think that makes a lot of sense. That's super cool. If people want to know more about this project, the thing that you're doing, is there like a place where people can go?
So that particular one, not really. It's got an RCT registration with the AEA, but that's about it. We're still gathering data. And of course the pandemic threw a big wrench into everything. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I would be surprised if we find that much, just because we randomized at the high school level. We don't really know necessarily what, you know, whether students were actually treated or not. And even the schools that are big feeder schools to A&M, ones that may send dozens of students, maybe only one or two of those students end up actually majoring in economics. And so, like I said, to me, this is, I don't think I'm doing harm. I hope I'm not doing harm.
Right. We're about to find out.
it'd be gratifying to have someone pull me aside 15 years at an NBER meeting or someone to say, you know, my guidance counselor told me that this guy at A&M said economics is great. And that's not going to happen. I'll sleep the sleep of the just, knowing that we're doing something good out here, even if we don't necessarily get an outsized reward for it.
Interesting. Cool. Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Now, next thing is that we want to dive a little bit into your workflow. So you're a full professor. So I think in Dragon Ball terms, you're a full Super Saiyan for my Dragon Ball Z fans. So can you walk us through your day-to-day workflow of what it's like? Maybe of how you plan your day or your week.
Boy, I wish I had some like really great magical thing to tell you guys here. I really don't. You know, I am at the stage of my career where I don't necessarily feel a ton of pressure to get things done. Or rather, I should say that I wouldn't, except I really like working with junior people, graduate students, and I feel a real sense of obligation to be on their timeline rather than sort of geological time that people at my stage of the career are. Plus I'm really wound up and I hate having things hanging over my head. I would say it's self-serving to say this, I guess, but I think I have a very high marginal product of labor that declines very steeply. And so I try to accomplish one thing and then treat myself. Okay. Now, I don't know if that's actually the way I should be doing it, but I do try to.
You get to use awesome memes then, right? Treat yourself.
Yeah, I do a lot of that. I do get to use some Parks and Rec memes, it's, you know, my wife has a demanding job. I was about to say also, except I don't know that I could say also. She has a demanding job, period.
You're right.
I put myself in that. And we have, you know, we have two school-age kids. So we have the weekly family meeting where we plan it out. We joke that it's like running a very small, very boring nonprofit.
Yeah.
And, you know, hyper-organized, who's picking up whom, what's being done when. You know, I've got my alerts on my phone and I use Todoist, which I like. It integrates nicely.
Me too. Heck yeah.
There you go. Integrates nicely with Google Calendar. I use You Can Book Me. Really great for avoiding that back and forth of you know, I'm busy then. So, you know, I tell students, look, you want to make an appointment with me? Just go for it. You don't have to ask. The academic advisors or our academic advising staff who are fantastic know that they can tell students, just use this link rather than adding that extra layer of friction in there. So I don't know that I have any killer comments, but one step at a time.
I have one quick question. So what percent of your time you think it's dedicated to research versus teaching versus other stuff that is neither of those, but still part of your job at this time?
Ooh. So we're subtracting off the leisure time here, right? So I don't have to tell you what the denominator is.
Totally.
I would say probably.
And you have to be honest.
I'm trying to be. I'd say probably 50% research, 30%. You know what? I'm gonna have to put teaching and service kind of together because most of my service revolves around undergrad related stuff. So I'd say it's probably 50-50. I also do some work with development and engagement and outreach also. So maybe 50% research, 40% teaching/teaching related service, and 10% sort of engagement, outreach, development related service.
Yeah, your description there made me think of, have you seen Emily Oster's new book she's about to release? It's called The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making.
And no, like, I love just, Emily's work, so I'm going to have to pick up a copy of that.
I think it's just, I pre-ordered it, so I don't think it's actually out yet, but like, I think the idea is like probably the way you organize your household is like, what's in this book?
Yeah. And I'm lucky because my wife is a senior executive at a charter school district. And so she runs a very large, very exciting nonprofit. So this is, you know, it's the family's a good side gig for her.
So today we want to discuss some tips for advising undergraduates. So some of our listeners could have been advising PhD students, graduate students, but also maybe a lot of us have to mentor or advise undergraduates. And obviously there are different populations that require kind of like different things and needs. So we wanted to talk about Jonathan with that. So maybe can you start by telling us what has been your experience with advising undergraduates so we understand that context?
Sure. Let me take it back even a step further that I think helps set the stage. So I had an amazing undergraduate research experience with Harvey Rosen, who was my undergrad advisor at Princeton. And I started working with him when I was 19. And by the time I'd finished college, we'd written two papers together. And we wrote another half dozen papers while I was in graduate school. So I got a very early start. And for whatever reason, and Harvey and I are still very close. We talk frequently. For whatever reason, Harvey took me seriously, even though I didn't know anything, and treated me like a real partner in this research project. And so I wanted the students at A&M to have the same kinds of opportunities that I'd had at Princeton, because as I got to know them, I really figured it out. And I think this is true, that the best students anywhere are really amazing. Mm. And I wanted to find a way to open the same kind of doors for them that had been opened for me. So in my second year as an assistant professor, I started an undergraduate research program, which Danila Serra runs now. I generally don't recommend starting, you know, huge service projects as a second year assistant professor, but I've been very lucky because I had a very supportive department head who really values undergraduate teaching and undergraduate support. That would be Tim Gronberg, who just finished a 10-year stint as the department head. And our new department head, Steve Poehler, is himself a great undergrad mentor who really values these things. Mm. And so after I became, after I was tenured, I became the undergraduate director, and I've been running that program for 7 years now. And I handed off the undergraduate research program, but that's sort of what got me down this path.
When you started that program, when you were an assistant, did that count as your service or that's just extra work?
I think that it did count as my service, and that was part of, you know, what having a great supportive department head gives you. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend a light version of that to young assistant professors, which would be find something that you actually maybe want to do or at least don't hate doing, mm-hmm. volunteer for that, mm-hmm. and then refuse to do anything else because you're already doing this other thing. Right. Maybe not an entire research program, but certainly something that you hate less, you know, rather than waiting for the assignment to come to you.
Great. So you started this program and then you became director of it. So tell us maybe what exactly are you doing in this program and how does it work maybe?
So I don't run the research program anymore, though I still advise students through, and I've co-authored a number of papers. I have a paper on that you mentioned actually at the top of the program that's co-authored with Camilla Adams, who is wrapping up a two-year RA-ship at Princeton applying to PhD programs now. She's one of our superstar students. And Carly Will Sloan, who's one of our recent graduates, mm-hmm. who's now at Claremont Graduate University, on the minimum wage and search effort. And that was Camilla's senior thesis. And, you know, it's a real paper. It's got an NBER number and everything. That's not the only paper I've written. I've written papers with students about how the Great Recession affected charitable giving. I really enjoy it because the smart students who are curious, you can teach them so much. And there's so many opportunities that you can show them.
So I have far less experience working with undergraduates, but I've recently successfully placed an undergraduate student at a PhD program, started a research paper with them. And something that I struggled with in this paper was like, I'm still learning as an assistant professor, like how to get a paper and write it and get it accepted. And like, it, like, how much easier does that get? And I guess maybe that's a silly question, but what tips do you have, maybe is a better way to say that, to like actually engage the student in the process? Like, do you have them do writing, or do you have it like, be like pre-prescribed tasks, or like what types of things do you do with the student to make it a successful endeavor?
So I wish I could give you a checklist, but it really depends on the student, because they have different levels of preparation. They have different, you know, some of them don't necessarily want to go to a PhD program, or they discover through the process of doing this that they're not as interested in research. And that's actually, and I promise I'll come back to your question, but I actually think that's a really important point.
Totally.
It's bad mentorship to want to just clone ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so I really, and it took me some time to kind of come to grips with this, because of course we want them to fall in love with, I want
to
be,
you don't want to change your name to Jonathan? I don't understand, right? Like,
yeah. I want to be just like you, Dad, right? So, right. So no, it's really important to support them in whatever it is that they want to do. Make sure that they know what is out there and put them in the position to be able to choose. But so the more nuts and bolts, how do you get them in the right position? It's tough because they don't know anything. And I don't mean that as a pejorative, like that's why they're there. They really don't know anything. And it's even back to, you know, they may not know Stata, they may not know R. I don't know R, but you know, they really don't know how to ask a question. Mm-hmm. And that was a mistake I made early on with this program, which was that I was not imagining myself as a freshman sophomore working with Harvey. I was imagining myself as like a senior having worked with Harvey for 3 years and be like, oh yeah, come back with a question. Let's figure it out. You know, mm-hmm. And they need to be handed a question. You mm-hmm. have to hand them a question. You have to give them a lot more guardrails on what they're doing. And what I found that's actually really successful, and I think really positive on a number of dimensions, is to loop a graduate student into this process. Because you, as the professor, don't necessarily have a ton of time to teach them Stata or teach them the basics of Stata. You can point them in the right direction, but they'll still get stuck. I mean, we get stuck, right?
Yeah.
But if they get stuck and then they get scared and then maybe they ghost because they're afraid of disappointing you, they're much more likely to be able to talk to a graduate student and can walk them through this. And then the advantage is, I have the graduate student say, like, look, what SCUT work do you need done? And the student can kind of, you know, bring that. And then what that enables me when I'm writing a letter for the PhD student is to say, I've seen this person mentor and I've seen this person guide and I know that they can do a good job. And I can say it very explicitly. Mm. I know this person is going to be a good advisor because I saw her do X, Y, and Z during this project with this student. And here's a specific situation where I was very impressed by her mentorship skills.
And what, for example, do they think in that scenario the grad student is getting out of it? It's the idea that, like, I mean, is this a grad student that also wants to do this? Or is this, do you think the grad student is getting something out of that mentorship part?
I hope they're getting something out of it. And I hope that they are getting, you know, we've had students, you know, cleaning data for them. So they get an undergraduate RA to some extent. Is it additional work for them? I think it is. But I do think it gives them valuable experience mentoring one-on-one, teaching. And again, there's a very explicit tie to me being able to describe them more thoroughly as a teacher or mentor advisor in that context.
And I guess the reason, so I really liked your point about like not wanting to clone ourselves. Like, so thank you for adding that. But the reason I was asking the question was also like, I find when I assign really specific tasks, like with guardrails, as you say, it seems to be like successful for the student and myself, or at least more likely to be successful. But a thing that like, I just haven't been able to get to work is like when I'm trying to collaborate in that writing of the paper. And maybe that's the part where I was like, do you just kind of have to take over that part you find, or like, are you
right? What like, tasks are doing maybe, right?
Like, yeah, I guess that's the kind of question I'm asking. Cause like, I want to make it as enjoyable for them as possible. And sometimes I feel like me being like, please go on these websites and download like these 7 Excel sheets or enter this data. Mm. Like, that's not the fun part of research, but like kind of like thinking of new ideas or like other things is. And that's the hardest part for me to engage with the undergraduate students on. Like, the fun stuff is the stuff that I feel like I don't know how to correctly engage them with.
Well, so it's a bit of a chicken egg, right? So, you know, how do you do the fun part about asking questions until you know how to do a Google Scholar deep dive, or how to get a data set cleaned up a bit and run some exploratory regressions, you know, the sorts of things that now we might you know, have a thought in the shower in the morning and say, I wonder. And by, you know, 11 a.m., you're like, no data on this. And which again, by the way, I'm not that much older than you guys, but I remember a time where you could spend months because there was no Google Scholar, or, you know, it wasn't easy. You had to write to BLS to get the data. But yeah, it'll happen. You'll shake your fist at the kids about how easy they have it. But in all seriousness, because this is explicitly tied to an undergraduate thesis, they write the first draft. But you have to teach them how to write. Now, thankfully, there's been this explosion of guides of how to craft a paper and so on. But you really have to prepare yourself for a lot of frustration with students. And, you know, we've had students who had, you know, they had 4 O's. They were obviously really smart. But what they wanted a gold star on their transcript and on their resume. And what they wanted was a guided problem set. And it's also very difficult to screen students because you have so little to go on. And so I've sort of tried to put up a couple of, you know, I used to when I was running the program, your application has to be exactly in this format, right? And if it's not exact, if you didn't read that line about exactly the format that it was in, then you're probably not going to pay a lot of attention when I tell you that you have to change all of the nines to missings in Stata, and you just give me a bunch of summary statistics with that in there. But it is very hard to screen on the non-cognitive skills that are the ones that really matter.
So one question with that, it seems like you were talking about these relationships that come about through like undergraduate wanting to do thesis or maybe more structured programs. In the places where maybe those things don't happen that often, like I'm thinking in situations where somebody, you know, comes to my office, which virtual, whatever, but to my virtual office, and they're like, hi, my name is X. You know, I really want to hear more about the research and I'm interested in working with you. That kind of like when the student seeks it out, like, you know, maybe if it happens once or twice, I don't need a process or a system, but what are some really good things to keep in mind when that happens, when the student reaches out to you and then maybe you want to engage with that student?
So one thing that can be helpful is if you've got a list of ideas that were maybe not enough for a paper, or they were some descriptive thing where at this stage of your career, you know, you know, there's not necessarily a ton of upside of saying, you know, I'm just curious about this fact that doesn't seem to be in evidence. Mm-hmm. And it's something that is straightforward enough for a student to cut their teeth on, where you're not feeling like, you know, if I don't get this thing out, it's going to be really bad for my tenure case. So if you've got, you know, if you've got a couple of those ideas sitting in your back pocket, that's a good one to kind of roll out. And I've got a few of those. And sometimes, you know, there's someone who worked on it for a year and they got a thesis out of it, but it wasn't to the point where I would put it in the NBR working paper series or something like that. And then 2 years later, another bright student comes along and they say, hey, you know, you could pick this thing up. And there's been a couple more years of data on, you know, the wage trajectories of low wage workers, you know, just something descriptive, something straightforward. And some of my papers have been like that, like the one about the Great Recession and charitable giving. You know, it's really just kind of using the PSID to look at some descriptive stats that weren't in evidence, and now they are. Mm-hmm.
I also think that, like, I like that because I think to me, descriptive work is, I mean, I love descriptive work and I don't get to do it as often, but it's also, I think what is valuable for me is that could sprint a lot of ideas. Because once you understand a fact and do a couple of like some samples and stuff like that, for me, it's like, oh my gosh, I don't think I connected these dots. And then you can think of ideas for them or for yourself, right? So I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I like this idea of not tying your, you know, the product of their work to your tenure decisions or whatever. Because when I was working with students pre-tenure, this was the only thing on my mind was like, I have these projects, I need to get them done. Like, how can you help me achieve this? But like separating that out would have probably better enabled me to like think more about like, what does this student need? What like is relevant and helpful for this student? And that reminds me a lot of what my own advisor did at Arizona, Price Fishback. He had a big sort of research program surrounding undergraduate research. And he's an economic historian. And basically he would like assign a state to a specific undergraduate, be like, you go look up Tennessee in like the 1930s and like learn about the different policies and things they had. And he might even know a lot about this already. And then he would have all of them present to each other and the graduate students at the end, where they would each do a different state around the same time period. And it was probably pretty generative for his own ideas, but it was also helpful for the students more than anything. So,
I mean, I think Joe Price at BYU, I think has like a advising pyramid. And so it's a system, you know, it's a system. And I think it's been incredibly successful. We've had some amazing PhD students at A&M who were products of, you know, the Joe Price system. And so I think there's something to that. And Alex, you made a really valuable point, which is the students really operate on a very different timeline than we do. You know, we might take 2 months to return an email, but to them, that's like, you know, a quarter of the time that they have to work on this senior thesis. And getting them started early, I think, is really valuable. So, you know, I've had students that started with me when they were sophomores, you know, if they were taking the econometrics class and getting all A's. And again, this is where asking your colleagues to identify those students and chat with them a bit and you know, just try to get a feel for, you know, are they really interested in this? And, you know, maybe assign them an early task and see, you know, are they actually going to come back with this and not ghost you? And I make that this students, I think they get stuck. They get embarrassed that they're stuck. And then they get embarrassed that they haven't contacted you in a while. And then they ghost. And I've had students who were, you know, like almost at the culmination of a project and they got and they disappeared. And then like 2 years later, I get like an apology email. It's like, you know, I'm so embarrassed. And I'm like, okay, I'm like, and I feel I have to be introspective about it. I'm like, was there something about our relationship that made them think that I would like hate them if they came to me? Like I said, I can't figure this out. Now, when they come to me and say, I can't figure this out, and it takes me 15 seconds of looking at the code and being like, yeah, you missed a semicolon there. That does irritate me a little bit. But, you know, that is part of the process. But looping back to, you know, sort of what you said about, you know, again, tying it to your tenure decision and so on, your reward for this is in heaven. This is a volunteer effort. It really is. And, in a well-run department, you will get like service credit and teaching credit for doing this sort of thing. But you really are doing it for the thank you notes, for the emails 5 years later of a student saying, you know, I don't think I'd be in this position if I hadn't written that thesis with you and, you know, opened my eyes to this other stuff. But I do think just interacting with undergrads can often be high return for low effort because it really is clearing up Rumsfeldian unknowns for them. They don't know what they don't know. And so just saying, hey, a smart person like you should be thinking about X, Y, and Z. And they take a look at that and they're like, well, I'm not really interested in X or Y, but Z sounds pretty interesting. I wonder about that. And I think those little moments, and we've all had them, can really steer the course of someone's life, hopefully in a positive way.
I guess I see it as also part of our duty, right? It's hard for me to think that like this is something I'm just doing because I'm nice, because I feel like it's something I kind of have to do, right? Like it's kind of weird to think that I'm going to be a scholar and never mentor anyone, right? What obviously maybe mentoring undergrads is different from mentoring PhD students, but at some point, I guess I also see it as like, I'm supposed to do this thing. Like, this is part of my job. Or is that is that not maybe the way that it should be seen then for some reason?
I mean, this may be an admission against interest for our profession, but I think if we're really honest with ourselves, for the vast majority of us, the thing that we do that has the most social value is educate undergrads. Now, I don't know whether that's we have the most value over whatever the replacement of that would be, replacement of us doing it. But, you know, we write interesting papers, I hope, and sometimes they have policy implications and sometimes they move the bounds of research forward. But I think that can pale in comparison to the impact that we can have on someone's life. Mm-hmm. But it is really the reward is the action itself. And you're not necessarily going to get rewarded very much by the market for it. We see that in the market wages for superstar lecturers versus superstar research active faculty. And I should say, I think, you know, there are a lot of complementarities between being research active and being a great instructor, or at least a passable one. I mean, there's been plenty of times that I've come back from an MBR meeting and gone to my economics of education class or my public economics class and said, you know, you guys asked about this last week and I told you we don't really know. Well, now we do have some evidence on it. We just saw it. And so there are these complementarities there, but it is not directly rewarded in general. Mm-hmm. And so you have to make your peace with that.
Right. Totally. Are there some general things that you've seen over the years that you can summarize that things not to do for people who may be starting to engage in this process?
I think that expecting them to be like a fully formed pre-doc RA type, because remember, this is the pre-pre-docs. These are the students who you may be putting in a great position to be at Harvard or Chicago or Princeton or Yale or wherever, or a Fed or something like that. So they really don't know anything yet. And they have no idea what economics research is. So you have to give them a question, but find something that they might be at least vaguely interested in. Oh, you're interested in education. You know, I've always wondered about teacher-student gender matches. Okay, and I've got a graduate student who's got data from Korea where they randomly assign teachers and students to classrooms. Now, why don't you tackle this sliver of a question, you know, part of the question that wouldn't necessarily be its own paper, but go in that direction rather than saying, oh, you're interested in international trade. Well, I've got an economics of education paper for you. Mm-hmm. You know, so take their preferences seriously. They got to have some guidance and some steering in this, but take them seriously and put them in the position to succeed. It can't just be, you know, go off and, I mean, we wouldn't do this to our PhD students. Here's an idea, come back in 9 months with a paper. Right. I mean, that's crazy. That's not mentorship.
Right. Before we wrap up, one, I think, question that I had in my mind is, I think there's some professors who start working with undergrads on a paper together. And I guess, what is your recommendation on how to determine co-authorship? Because sometimes people, I think that's like a weird thing where, maybe if you set it from the straight, like, oh, we're both going to be co-authors, that's great. And others, it's like this expectation of like, well, I'm going to be the author and you just helping the project. So like, what, is there any tip there? Just maybe set expectations from the get-go or some other way of addressing that?
It depends. You know, I think different people have different lines that they're going to draw in this. If a student was cleaning data for me and then maybe running a few regressions and maybe they took it and, you know, my question is X and they do, you know, X, you know, tiny X prime as their thesis, then maybe not. But if they're working hand in hand with me, then I do think it's important. And again, I'm at a stage of my career where it doesn't hurt me to be co-authoring. So, you know, I can make a different calculation there.
I guess I have a follow-up question on this. So when you have a student who's in this position that you're definitely co-authoring, or at least they're doing their own thing, how often do you have them like push them to present their work in front of others? Is that a thing that you do? Do you take them to conferences, or do you have them present to each other? Because I find that to be beneficial personally. And I think it's something students don't get too much of.
So they present as part of the Student Research Week that Texas A&M's Independent Research, so this is university-wide thing, does, and that's more of the sort of poster presentation. We pay to send them to, the Dallas Fed has or had an undergraduate research conference. The Eastern Economic Association has one that's associated with them, with that, and we've sent students there. We've sent students to the Association of Private Enterprise Education a couple times to present their work. So we do that. We probably don't do enough internal presenting, you know, and maybe that's something where we should have more like reading group type stuff. But this really does require someone to run the program and say, you know, this is your service. And maybe even it's like a half a class credit or something like that. But it's really explicitly your service there. I would add that, you know, every now and then someone will say, you know, why don't we use this formula-based method for determining how much credit you get for co-authorship? I don't know if you guys have ever seen these things. And my hand always goes up. I'm like, can I get 3x for, you know, not 1/n times the impact factor. I want n to the nth power, the number of undergrad co-authors I'm working with on this.
Awesome. So we talked a little bit about tips for mentoring undergraduates, and I'm just going to try to hit some of the highlights here. So I think some of the stuff that I liked the most was just treat them like a partner and with respect, right? You mentioned that is something you liked.
The
basics of human interaction, right? Like to be another human.
It shouldn't be a high bar to clear.
I think it's higher.
That's the sad part, right?
Than it should. Yeah, it's high for some people. And then something that I liked quite a bit, because it just made me kind of rethink, like I wish I would have been thinking about this from the get-go, is, you know, bad mentorship is when you want to clone yourself and don't tie things for your own personal benefit to the student's productivity. This is about them. It's not about you. And when you're thinking about them, they don't even know what they don't know, right? I like that sort of Knightian, Rumsfeldian uncertainty that you're talking about here. And this idea of pairing in a graduate student and some sort of different layers of interaction is quite nice as well. And then I also kind of like the ideas that you had about selecting students or finding students that might be a good match. So you just had like kind of like, you know, if you want a good match for you might not be someone who wants a guided problem set. So figuring out ways to make sure that the right types of students you're doing research on. And then also in this idea of what they don't know, what they don't know, they're not going to have like a Excel spreadsheet of like questions that they're really interested in that are well formulated and well suited for applied micro techniques.
I don't have those either. So, yeah.
But maybe you should keep those because then you could review them when the students come right?
No, I was going to say, I don't have good research ideas of questions. Yeah. But yeah.
you're brimming with them, man. Come on. You can't read a New York Times article without thinking of four more papers. And then also just be aware that like students are people and they might get stuck and be embarrassed and then not talk to you again. And trying to figure out ways or systems or processes, whatever you want to do to mitigate that is important as well.
Well, great. Thank you so much for those insights. Every week, we like to ask our guests for our recommendation of the week. This can be anything, a podcast, a command, an app, a song, a quote, a book, a kitchen, a recipe, a cocktail recipe maybe, that improves your life in any small way. Jonathan, what is your recommendation of the week?
So we're going to be traveling again soon, fingers crossed. Something that I've been doing for years and years, which was driven in large part by the way that I tend to listen to music anyway, but then I started doing it deliberately, which is I pick one artist or even one album, and then I only listen to that while I'm on a trip. Huh. And then I don't listen to it at all when I come back for at least a couple of weeks. And what I find is that it forms these really strong connections in my mind. And I can be transported to that place when I listen to that music, even years later, even more than a decade later. And not just, you know, the images of the place that I was, but really the feeling that I was having, you know, when I was blasting down the highway in, you know, in the Southwest, or when I was...
what album is that?
What was that?
What album is that?
That would be Nico Case's Middle Cyclone. I can use that to transplant myself to Southern Utah whenever I want. Or the Queen Charlotte track in New Zealand, or to Alaska, or you know, to walking through Ljubljana. And I've got that for dozens of albums. And in some cases I can attach it with enough distance and time to multiple places. Now, I imagine that might not work for everyone. I've heard of people doing this with scents. Sometimes like they'll wear a different perfume or cologne to a different place. But if it does work for you, then I really recommend this because it helps form these strong memory bonds.
That's really cool. Yeah, that is really cool. I was thinking like also it's gonna be really funny because imagine you didn't like a trip, right? So you hear that song and then you're like, people are like, why are you so sad? It's like, oh, you know, like I was thinking like, what if you start hearing like, it's a small world after, you're like, no.
that's Disney. That's just stuck being Disney, right?
Now you've got it in my head. That was bad.
Okay, Alex, what is your recommendation of the week?
All right. So I'm definitely in danger of giving a second time. I don't know. I need like a master list of all my recommendations.
We totally do. Yeah.
But I love Lego grad student. It's I think it's an Instagram thing, but I recently bought the artist's calendar. So you guys can see it because we're on Zoom here. And it's basically this guy or girl. I don't actually know who does it. Some person creates all these Lego scenes that are like a grad student. And it's something like, for this January, it was like a scene of a Lego person on a Zoom call. And it was like the Lego grad student sets up Zoom call. So the only clean corner of her apartment is showing behind him. And it just, I don't know. It kind of reminds me of grad school. So it's like a little nostalgic. They're hilarious. That's pretty funny. Awesome.
I love Lego grad student. I've seen like a couple of memes on them, but that's awesome. My recommendation of the week is to check out a new kind of like organizational group that I got an email recently. Which is the Association for Economic Research of Indigenous People, or AERIP. I'm terrible at spelling. I'll put a link into the show notes. But it's a new association that would obviously be focusing on research for Indigenous populations. So make sure that if you're interested in that, to support them. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan, for being here with us today. If people want to find out more about you and your work, where should they go?
So I have a webpage. It's one of those, you know, long A&M web pages. So it's people.tamu.edu/jmeir, but you can just Google for Jonathan Meir, T-A-M-U, TAMU, and you can find my research there.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you. That's all what we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review and let your friends know about the podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
I just want to say, I know a bunch of my former students, maybe even some of my current students, are probably listening to this. And yes, when I'm talking about great students, I am thinking of you. Just want to make that really clear.